viste que cavava i slime di sé e che lo
Thank you for tuning in to IKIM FM. You're with me, Mazlina Ismail. I'm bringing to you a special interview today, as mentioned, with a very profound scholar, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf Hansen. And for your information, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf is a president, co-founder, and senior faculty member of Zaytuna College. He is an advisor to Stanford University's program in Islamic Studies and the Center for Islamic Studies at Berkeley's Graduate Theological Union. And Sheikh Hamza Yusuf was ranked as the Western world's most influential Islamic scholar by the 500 most influential Muslim. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Hamza.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Alhamdulillah. Welcome to IKIM FM.
Okay, sama sama.
This is not your first time to Malaysia,
no,
I suppose.
No, third time.
So thank you very much for being with us.
Thank
for
you.
Being with IKIM FM listeners today. And you've been in Malaysia for nearly a week now.
More than that. Almost 2 weeks.
So how do you find Malaysia this time around?
Alhamdulillah. No, it's good. Malaysia to me is there's two places I've been in the Muslim world. Well, actually, probably three that I've been in the Muslim world where I really feel that there's an identity that has not been so corrupted by the modern times. Because a lot of people, they lose their identity in the globalized world, and then the post-colonial problem is severe as well for Muslim countries. But I really feel that there is a Malay identity. I know that you have Malaysians, but with the Malay people that are mostly Muslim, I really feel there's a Malay identity that lets me know that I'm with Muslims that have a distinct cultural and religious identity, which is really nice.
Mm-hmm.
And then Turkey also, despite the trauma of the period after the fall of the Caliphate, where Muslims were really suppressed for a long, long time. But despite that, and it shows you how strong the Turkish religious identity was, is that if you go into the villages and the towns and the smaller cities, you really see a truly Turkic Muslim identity.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think another beautiful country is Oman in the Arabian Peninsula. They call it the Switzerland of the Arab world. And by that, they just simply mean it's a highly functioning society, which is really nice to see. So, yeah.
MashaAllah. Alhamdulillah. Thank you very much. Okay, Sheikh, on a more serious note now, perhaps we can talk about knowledge, where you have been speaking on the issue of crisis of knowledge on several occasions here.
Mm-hmm.
If you may explain, what do you mean by the crisis
okay.
of knowledge?
Well, before we do that, I would like to just have a few comments about the hadith that we just heard.
Yeah.
That was related. That hadith is a famous hadith. It's in Imam al-Tirmidhi, Shama'il.
Mm-hmm.
It's related by somebody who knew the Prophet intimately, lived with him.
Mm-hmm.
But it's called the Hilya, traditionally. And it's a description of the Prophet, which is very important, because one of the things that every believer will be tested by is in the grave, it will be said to them, first, who is your Lord? Man Rabbuka. And then, what is your religion? And then, what do you say about this man? And it says, هَذَا الرَّجُلُ, which the Arabs use for presence. So people will actually see the Prophet in their grave.
Mm-hmm.
And they should know the description so they recognize him. So that's traditionally why the Hilya was very important for people. And the other thing about the Hilya is, what's stunning about the Prophet's physical description is that he was balanced in everything.
Mm-hmm.
He was neither short nor tall. You know, he was of moderate stature.
Yeah.
His skin was neither pasty white nor was it dark. It was a middle color.
Mm-hmm.
His physical appearance was moderate. His hair was neither straight nor curly. It was wavy. That everything was balanced.
Mm-hmm.
So the Prophet ﷺ is a perfectly balanced human being, not just spiritually and intellectually, but also physically. And so it's very important for Muslims to remember that our religion is a religion of balance, of i'tidal. The Prophet was mu'tadil in everything. You would call all those descriptions that were given of him, of that it's mu'tadil, it's in between. You know, he could have been very tall, but he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Although he always appeared taller than whoever he was with, but that was one of his miracles.
Mashallah.
So, in terms of the crises of knowledge, I mean, I believe that that the crisis in the Muslim world is always a crisis of knowledge, that every crisis that the world faces is ultimately a crisis of knowledge. Mm-hmm. If you look, for instance, at the economic crisis, the real economic crisis is not about collapsing markets, it's not about derivatives, it's not about AAA loans being passed off, or single A loans being passed off as AAA loans. You know, those are all symptoms of a much deeper crisis, and the crisis is ultimately about what is economics, and then what drives human beings to greed. Why are they greedy, and why will they, because of their greed, do things that are harmful to other people? What is it in the psychological makeup of certain people that greed will be so destructive that they will actually destroy themselves as well as others? Those are all problems of knowledge. They're not there. So, and then political problems. Why do politicians fail so often? Because they don't utilize the knowledge they have. For instance, many of our problems now, we actually know what causes them. We have social scientists that study these things, but social science isn't used. For instance, we know what produces extremism. We know the social circumstances that produce extremism, and we know the types, the psychological profiles of people that become extremists, but that knowledge is not used. Instead, false knowledge is presented, platitudes. For instance, the Palestinians, Mark Twain visited Palestine over 100 years ago. He didn't describe them as being violent, quite the opposite. He didn't experience them as violent. We know that Florence Nightingale lived for almost 2 years in Egypt, and she also lived in Turkey, and she actually has wonderful things to say. She was troubled by certain things that she saw in the political class, but by and large she was very struck by a lot of the positive things about Islam. And so how is it that somebody over 100 years ago could write very positive things about Islam, and yet today it's very difficult for people to say anything positive about Islam, right? This is a corruption of knowledge, because Islam has been presented as something other than it is, and there's agendas behind that. So for me, all of the problems that we are confronted with, the ills of the world, are ultimately related to how we understand the world. And so understanding is central. Changing our understanding, rectifying our knowledge is really important.
Inshallah. Shah, you mentioned, there's a quote about innocence, ignorant, and compounded ignorance in UITM. Could you explain
that? Well, I was struck. I was with Sayyidina Naqib al-Attas the other day, and he used innocent ignorance and arrogant ignorance. And I hadn't heard those terms before. Generally, the way I learned it was compounded ignorance and simple ignorance. But I actually liked the idea of using innocent ignorance and arrogant ignorance, because essentially that's getting, by saying compound ignorance and simple ignorance, you're not getting to the real problem. Because innocent ignorance is when people have a purity that enables them to say, I don't know. Because being able to say, I don't know, comes from, like a child. A child will just say, I don't know. Whereas, there's an essay written by an American philosopher, which unfortunately, he entitled it with a word that I don't say privately, so I certainly won't say it on the radio. But anyway, the initials are BS. And what he argued in that is that there was so much BS in the world, he asked the question in the essay, why? Why is there so much people just pretend to know things, and they just say things, and it's just rubbish. That's what the British call it, rubbish. It used to be called balderdash, just empty, kalam fadhi. The Iraqis say hachi fadhi, empty words. Why is there so much of that? He argues in there because people feel they have to have an opinion about everything, and that's a disease. Just to be able to say, I don't know. In fact, our scholars used to teach I don't know as part of knowledge, and they would say that it was half of knowledge. If you know I don't know, you already know half of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And they warned about saying, لَا تَقْفُ مَا لَيْسَ لَكَ بِهِ عِلْمٍ. Don't say things that you don't have knowledge of. The Quran warns us. لا تقولوا تصفوا ألسنتكم الكذب. هذا حلال وهذا حرام لتفتروا على الله الكذب. Don't describe with your tongues by saying lies about Allah's deen. This is halal and this is haram. So we're warned about these things, and yet arrogant ignorance is what compels people out of arrogance. Even though they're ignorant, but their arrogance assumes that I can't be ignorant because I'm me. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm so important. Yes. My opinions are so important. So we flooded the world with empty opinions. We have all these people talking nonsense. Mm-hmm. And people that know the subject they're talking about can see that they're just full of you know, air. They're hot air,
yes.
You know. But this is a problem. And mm-hmm. so simple ignorance, it's really important. Traditionally, people who didn't know, they would just say, go ask so-and-so, he knows. Sahaba, mm-hmm. radiallahu anhum, they didn't like to answer questions. They used to defer it to other people because they felt the heaviness of having to say what the religion says about something. Mm-hmm. It's a weighty thing. Mm-hmm. Now we have every Tom, Dick, and Abdullah just feels compelled to give their opinions on the internet. We have what they call trolls,
yes.
You know, these empty people with yes. vacuous lives mm-hmm. that have no meaning other than to find meaning by defaming or slandering or attacking the words of other people. Mm-hmm. That's what we have. We have empty people that won't even write their real names.
Mm-hmm.
They won't even say where they're from.
Yes.
They're just empty people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have empty suits walking around. The lights are on, nobody's home.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a crisis of the modern people. We've become empty people. One of the things, humans are called thaqalain, the two weighty ones. Humans and jinn, they're called thaqalain. That's what the Quran calls them, weighty ones. We're weighty creatures. We're not frivolous, empty creatures. We're supposed to have gravitas, weight. There was a film recently called Gravity, which was just about these idiots out in space floating around.
Mm-hmm.
And this is modern man. We've been freed from the atmosphere of the earth. We're spiritually without gravity. There's nothing that's holding us down spiritually anymore. So we're just floating in space.
Subhanallah. It is something related to what you said in Masjid Wilayah, that even with the advance of technology, with social network, sit down in your room all by yourself, you're making riba, you're making noise.
Exactly. It's amazing. Yeah, it's just astaghfirullah.
Yes.
That's what we have to say,
yes.
Astaghfirullah.
Okay, Sheikh, what you have achieved thus far has envied many Muslims all over the world in terms of a mastery of various Islamic disciplines, Western philosophy, Arabic language and others. How can one emulate you in the pursuit of knowledge to achieve that level of par excellence, Sheikh?
Well, I mean, I'm a student of knowledge. I don't consider myself really a scholar. I'm probably by Western standards,
mm-hmm.
but by the standards of my own teachers. I mean, my teachers were, you know, they started when they were very young. I became Muslim when I was 18. So the key years are from about 7 till about 20
mm-hmm.
for if you really want to master the Islamic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard once you get into, the post teen period, study becomes more difficult, the memorization is not mm-hmm. as easy, and our tradition demands a lot of rote memorization. But you have to love knowledge. Not everybody is meant to be a scholar. God did not intend for all of us to be scholars. We should all love scholars.
Mm-hmm.
We should all honor scholars. Omar ibn Abd al-Aziz said that you should be a scholar, and it's based on a hadith, but he said you should be a scholar. He said about
mm-hmm.
the statement of the Prophet, be a scholar, or be a student of a scholar, or be a helper of a scholar, or at least love them. If you can't mm-hmm. afford to help them, at least love them, and don't become other than those and
mm-hmm.
perish. And so Omar ibn Abd al-Aziz said about that, he said God, the Prophet didn't leave, he gave everybody a place.
Mm-hmm.
So like Imam al-Ghazali's father was a very simple man. He's a wool carder.
Okay.
In fact, some say that Ghazali is actually a Ghazali with a shadda because his father was a Ghazal.
Mm-hmm.
He carded wool. But He was not a scholar, but he loved scholars, mm-hmm. and he served them, and he begged God to that his children would be scholars. He had two sons, Ahmed and Muhammad, Abu Hamid. Obviously, he loved the Prophet ﷺ. He named them both after the Prophet, and they became, both of them became great scholars, mm-hmm. you know. So and the parents of a Hafidh of Quran are given a crown of light on the Day of Judgment. So even if you're not a scholar, you should hope at least one of your children becomes mm-hmm. a scholar.
Yes.
You know, Muslims, like Irish Catholics, because I come from a Orthodox Catholic background. My father was Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
But the Irish Catholics used to always give one, at least one son to the priesthood and one daughter as a nun.
Mm-hmm.
They had big families, but it was something they just, that's what you did if you were Irish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they love their religion.
Yeah.
And Muslims should really want, you know, at least one of their children they should all want them to all learn the deen and practice the deen, but they should at least want one of them
mm-hmm.
to, because it's such a noble thing. This mm-hmm. is the wazifa of the prophets, is to call people to the truth. That's
mm-hmm.
the wazifa. That's their, the Prophet said, إِنَّمَا بُعِثْتُ مُعَلِّمًا. People don't want to be teachers anymore. You know, they don't, and I'm not talking about becoming, a lot of people want to be famous,
mm-hmm.
which is a sickness. You know, a lot of people look at, like, you know, people that have, you know, a kind of celebrity status,
yes.
in our tradition now, because of media and these things. That's just a tribulation.
Yes.
The Prophet said it's enough of a fitna so that people point fingers when you walk by.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a disease to want to do that. But to want to be somebody who teaches elementary school
mm-hmm.
and forms the minds of young people, that's a very noble pursuit. And we don't have enough really talented people that want to do those jobs, because they're jobs that don't have a lot of social status anymore. And it's questionable whether they ever did, except in very rare periods.
Inshallah, the parents can start making dua at least for their children.
So, I mean, I would just say in summation that you have to love knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell students at Zaytuna, the first year students,
mm-hmm.
I say, if you don't love to read, if you don't love, if dictionaries aren't one of your favorite pastimes, like I read dictionaries for fun.
Mashallah.
You know, so if dictionaries aren't one of your favorite pastimes, you're in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're in the wrong place. You know, if you want to come and do dhikr or recite, inshad or something like that, that's not the path of study.
Mm-hmm.
You can go do that other places.
Mm-hmm.
People do that. They, you know, even Sufism now, tasawwuf was a serious pursuit study. You know, the Sufis were traditionally great scholars. Now the Sufis it's rare to find Sufis that have real knowledge. They don't know fiqh. They don't know aqidah. They don't, you know, but they, you know, they're nice people.
Mm-hmm.
They have good character, but they're not of the early Sufis. It's very rare to find that, unfortunately.
Mashallah. Okay, Sheikh. Speaking of Zaytuna, mm-hmm. just now, being an American and a Muslim scholar in the United States of America, how do you see your role, along with Zaytuna College, would convey the true teachings of Islam, especially in America? And yes.
Well, I mean, you know, I would say that making claims is a very dangerous thing in our tradition. There's people that claim to be the saved sect, you know, al-firqatun najiyah. If you ever hear anybody say that we're on the truth,
mm-hmm.
then you should, red flags should go up. In fact, in the Quran, when Allah says, وَإِذَا قِيلَ لَهُمْ لَا تُفْسِدُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ قَالُوا إِنَّمَا نَحْنُ مُصْلِحُونَ أَلَا إِنَّهُمْ هُمُ الْمُفْسِدُونَ وَلَكِنْ لَا يَشْعُرُونَ. Sadaqallah al-Azim. So Allah says, you know, if it's said to them, don't sow corruption in the earth, they say, we're not corrupting, we're only setting things straight. And then God says about these people, after describing what they say, He says, indeed, aren't they the corruptors, but they're unaware. You know, it's like, they don't even know. In other words, it's that arrogant ignorance.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And what Imam al-Qurtubi says in his tafsir is the first sign
mm-hmm.
that they're not rectifying is that they claim to be rectifying.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first sign. The fact that they're saying we're setting things right
yes.
is the first sign that they're not. They're doing the opposite. Because the people that really do the work, They don't make the claims. And so it's very dangerous to make claims. And what I would hope, I think every Muslim should be certain about Islam, but they should always have a sense of fallibilism about their understanding of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
We hope that our understanding is the correct understanding,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we should believe that.
Yes.
But this idea somehow that my understanding is the only understanding, is the only correct understanding, that is the height of arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe in what I'm doing, and I believe that I believe in the four madhabs. That's what makes sense to me. Not because I was taught that, and I was taught that,
mm-hmm.
but because, you know, because I became Muslim as an adult, and I already had a formed intellect.
Okay.
And so when I came into Islam, I got very interested, for instance, in the beginning, you know, I became Muslim with Sunnis, but because of the Iranian Revolution, I got very interested in the Shia. Because for me, I was just a Muslim. You know, and I didn't have any tribe. You know, I wasn't born in Iran or born, you know, I was born in America. So I got interested in the Shia tradition,
okay.
you know, because it was very exciting at that time. This is 1979, mm-hmm. 80. And so I started studying about the Shia tradition. But what struck me about Shia tradition that really bothered me
mm-hmm.
was I couldn't understand how the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam could have companions for all his life, like Abu Bakr,
yes.
and that he was a bad guy. The Prophet just didn't know it. That just didn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't. So it didn't convince me. Like when I read it, it just didn't convince
mm-hmm.
me. You know, I know the fitna, and I've studied that period, and there was a lot of terrible things that were done to the Ahlul Bayt, but the argument that was made
okay.
just didn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when I studied about the madhabs, the argument made perfect sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
One, it made me feel like that was part of the beauty of Islam, that there were different ways of interpreting,
mm-hmm.
and that each school acknowledged the other school's validity in differing with them because they were based on sound methodological principles.
Okay.
So that made sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then also in Aqidah, it made sense to me that you would need a sophisticated dialectical theology. That made sense to me because new problems would arise and you would have to have some way of addressing those problems. So this idea that somehow the theology that developed in Islam is prohibited and that this is a bid'ah or something
mm-hmm.
like that didn't make sense to me. So I was very convinced by these arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the tasawwuf, which is the spiritual psychology of Islam, understanding the self, that made sense to me. With criticism, I mean, the greatest critic of the Sufis was Imam al-Ghazali.
Okay.
You know, if you read what he has to say, he was very critical. And he wrote a book about the delusions of the Sufis. So the idea that anybody who claims to be a Sufi is simply rightly guided, that's foolishness. But tasawwuf as a science
mm-hmm.
is part of Islam. And should be taught as such. And so for me, that's the foundation of a sound tradition. And this is the Malay Islam. You know, you were Shafi'i,
yes.
right? And you were Ash'ari.
Yes.
And then you had different Sufi traditions
mm-hmm.
in your culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Islam that you embraced.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Islam that made sense to your ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
So to change that now,
mm-hmm.
to say, oh, they were wrong. So you've been wrong all these mm-hmm. hundreds of years, and now we're going to bring you the true Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that means what you accepted wasn't Islam.
Yeah.
It was something else.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you have to reassess the whole religion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this kind of argument just doesn't make sense.
Having said that, in Malaysia today, if you see the wave of returning to true teachings of Islam, particularly among the youth, is overwhelming, alhamdulillah, especially among students, professionals, and urban groups, I must say. Some people resort to the internet like YouTube, Google, Wikipedias, and recorded lectures by scholars within and outside the country to learn about Islam. But what is your advice, Shah, in order to stay on track on our deen and not to be influenced by the teachings or ideology that might contravene to the teachings of the Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah or the mainstream
yeah.
Islam here in Malaysia?
Well, the first thing to remember is a lot of groups claim to be Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they claim to be.
Yeah.
But and we should be wary, like I said, of claims. But we should be able to say that we know for certain who was Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And we should try to be as close to them. And the Ahl Sunnah of the past for over 1,000 years followed one of the four madhabs.
Okay.
I mean, at Al-Azhar, which was a great bastion of Sunni thought,
mm-hmm.
for the last 400 years, they've almost 400 years, they've taught Ibrahim al-Laqani's Jawhara. Mm-hmm. And in there, he says, وَمَالِكُمْ وَسَائِرُ الْأَئِمَّةِ كَذَا أَبُ الْقَاسِمُ هُدَاتِ الْأُمَّةِ فَوَاجِبٌ تَقْرِيدُ حَبْرًا مِنْهُمُ كَذَا حَكَ الْقَوْمُ بِلَبْذٍ يُفْهَمُ, which means... that Malik and he was a Maliki, but he said Malik and the other three imams, as well as Abu Qasim, meaning Imam al-Junayd, the way of the tasawwuf of Imam al-Junayd, which Imam Ibn Taymiyyah, who's used sometimes as a sledgehammer against Sufism, he agreed that Imam Junayd was a rightly guided imam. So that way they said that it's an obligation to follow one of these imams, and that was understood. That Muslims had to follow an imam. I mean, I'll give you an example, very simple example to show
yes.
the complexity of this.
Okay.
It, whenever you have a hadith, and it's prohibited for common people to read a hadith without a teacher,
mm-hmm.
But whenever you have a hadith, the alim, the scholar, has to understand how was the Prophet speaking?
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes he was speaking as a mufti, and sometimes he was speaking as a qadi, and sometimes he was speaking as a judge, a ruler, a sultan, because
mm-hmm.
he was all those things. Sometimes he's speaking as somebody giving advice.
Okay.
So for instance, in the hadith, which is in the Sahih collection, Hind, the wife of Abu Sufyan, comes to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and she says, Abu Sufyan doesn't give me enough money to live. And so what should I do?
Okay.
And so he said, خُذِي مِن مَالِهِ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ, take from his money what's socially acceptable for
mm-hmm.
your status in Mecca. Take what you need.
Mm-hmm.
Which meant take it without his permission.
Mm.
Now Abu Hanifa radiallahu anhu said the Prophet was acting as a mufti.
Okay.
And so that means that a woman can take money from her husband
mm-hmm.
Without him knowing if he's not giving her enough.
Mm-hmm.
But Imam Malik said no, he was acting as a qadi. And so it's only the qadi that can give the woman permission to do that.
Course, yes.
It's a different, do you understand
yes.
the difference?
Yes.
So the same hadith mm-hmm. arrives at two different conclusions. In other words, with the qadi, every case is individual, and the qadi has to look into the case.
Yes.
But with the mufti, also it's individualized, but he's giving a general hukum,
yes.
just a ruling.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many examples of that in our tradition. So people that go directly to the Quran and the hadith will go astray. They will go astray,
mm-hmm.
and they will lead others astray. And the Prophet said mm-hmm. in the hadith in al-Bukhari that one of the signs of the end of time is that knowledge is taken from people, and he said, and then people will take ignorant people as their knowledge heads.
Mm-hmm.
These are the arrogant, ignorant ones.
Mm-hmm.
And he said they will ask them questions, and they will give them fatwa,
mm-hmm.
and they will go astray by doing it, and lead others astray by giving them that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a big problem. So now we have this Daesh, what they call the Dawla al-Islamiyya fil Iraq wa Sham. You know, we have these people in Syria and Iraq, the chopping off heads and doing all these horrible things
mm-hmm.
in the name of Islam. Where are they getting their sources? They're reading the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
They'll quote you verses.
Yes.
Darbu al-Riqab, the
mm-hmm.
Quran says, strike their heads off.
Mm-hmm.
They'll quote you verses, but those aren't the meanings of those verses. And that's why the Prophet said that these are people, لا يتجاوز القرآن حناجرهم. The Quran won't go past their throats.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they'll recite it, but the meanings won't get to their hearts. That's how he described them. And in the riwayah of Nu'aym bin Hamad, in the chapter of Fitan, he said, when you see the black flags coming, you know, the black flags, and he said, then you see these people, they will have names where they, like Abu Kuna, Asma'uhum Kuna, they will have names like Abu Fulan, and he said they will be the Nasabuhum al-Qura, that their names will go back to towns and like countries like al-Libi, al-Masri, al-Iraqi,
mm-hmm.
al-Baghdadi.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he said. And then he said, and their hair will be long, right? And he said, when you see them, then he said, these will be people without wafa. They're not loyal people. They're treacherous people. And he condemned them. So this is one of the signs, you know, that these people were warned about. But people don't know these things. They're
yes.
ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so people think, oh, this is the Dawla Islamiyya.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a Dawla Islamiyya. It's fawda.
Yeah.
You know, it's anarchy. And you look at them, they're like little kids. I mean, they had one of them that was really spinning a tank around. I don't know if you saw that footage from CNN. He was literally spinning a tank like adolescents do with a car. You know, when they get a car and they like to spin it in circles.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's doing with the tank. I looked at him and said, these are just little punks. You know, they're like kids,
yeah.
but unfortunately they're not kids. They're adults and they're responsible for their actions, and Muslims are fooled by this. I don't know which Muslims, but there are, because there are people going from other countries,
yes.
And I hope the Malay are spared that. I mean, a man
sure.
came to the Prophet and he said, "Ya Rasulullah, idhni fil jihad. I want to go on jihad." And he said, "Are your parents alive?"
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Yes." And he said, "Fafihi ma fajahid. Do your jihad by taking care of your parents."
Mm-hmm.
And also in Sharia, you have to ask your parents' permission to go and fight. They have a right to say no. You need to stay. I need you.
Mm-hmm.
They have that right. You know, Islam is not this simplistic religion. It's simple. Anybody can understand the basics of Islam, but it's a complex tradition, and you can't just think that these simplistic answers or solutions are going to address the real complex troubles of our time.
Inshallah, Sheikh, I would like to also share with you some of the questions from our listeners
All
right now.
Yeah.
Maria Marzuki, she asked, please share some family tips that you adopt and apply to ensure your children and family at large are learning the deen on a strong foundation and correct methodology, knowing the surroundings are full of fitna and signs of end of time. Balancing, as you said earlier, go all out seeking ilm with protection from Jahannam.
Mashallah. What's her name?
Maria Marzuki.
Maria, see, what an excellent question.
Mashallah.
You know, really, it's a good question. You know why?
Yeah.
Because it's a practical question. Muslims now, that they're concerned about things that should be of you know, no practical concern of theirs. The Prophet ﷺ said, "Min husni Islam al-mar yutarkuhu ma la ya'nihi." From the beautiful Islam of a man, that he minds his own business.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a really good question, you know, about what do we do in our homes. The first thing I would say, you know, the after prayer, the biggest chapter in fiqh books is family law.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why is it very important?
It's very important because after your personal relationship with God, the next most important relationship is the relationship of the family. And then the next biggest chapter is commercial law.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hanafis, I heard from Sheikh Nizam al-Yaqubi, that the Hanafi students, they study a famous book of Hanafi fiqh, and they divide it into three sections.
Okay.
So they have, the first section is ibadat, so you learn the five pillars.
Mm-hmm.
The second section is ankiha, so you learn the marriage laws.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last section is commercial law. And so they say that the first section, the teacher and the students understand it.
Mm-hmm.
The second section, the teacher understands it, but the students don't understand it.
Okay.
And the third section, the teachers don't understand it and the students don't understand it. Because we're so divorced from real practical commercial solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Malaysia is at the cutting edge of trying to revamp the Islamic finance tradition. You have to recognize how important that is. Malaysia is literally at the cutting edge. I mean, there's some of the Gulf states are concerned about this, but Malaysia is really trying to do a lot to get into Islamic finance and provide. I was with one of the senators here who was the editor of a textbook on Islamic finance, very comprehensive, you know, so it's really good. So in terms of in the house, the first thing to note is that your house is Darul Islam, and the parents are the president and the PM in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And the children are your subjects.
Okay.
You know, they're the citizens of the house.
Okay.
And so you have to run the house like a little country.
Mm-hmm.
And so you really have to see it as a country.
Mm-hmm.
And that you have to defend the house from invasion. And one of the biggest invasions is the television.
Oh.
Because the armies of Iblis come in with the television.
Mm-hmm.
It really, they come in. If you turn on that television, it's like having an open sewer in your front room. It's just like, it's just letting all that filth come into those pure innocent children's minds. And so that's my primary advice, is that recognize that the television, you should not have broadcast television.
Mm-hmm.
If you do have a screen, then you should monitor what they watch, and it should be very limited, because obviously, you know, if you completely prohibit it, which the Orthodox Jews do, by the way, in America, the Orthodox Jews have no televisions in their homes. Mm-hmm. So, and same with the Amish people, have no television. So Christians and Jews, there are Christian and Jews that do it. Okay, so it's not like you can't do it. Mm-hmm. There are people from other traditions that do it.
Okay.
But what sometimes happens, especially when you're living in a society where all the other children do it, is it becomes the thing they're prohibited from. And the Arabs say, "Aladul asha mahurimat," you know, the most delightful things are the things prohibited. So kids will want to go, and then they'll start being hypocritical, go behind your back.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to have, you know, maybe some things that if you have Islam, some Muslim friendly things that they can see that are really monitored, you know, like once a week or something.
Mm-hmm.
That's what, in the early period, I didn't let my kids see anything, but then I saw that they would go to other people's houses and do things.
Mm.
So you know, as time went on, I realized that I had to do something about it. So I tend to, you know, let them see something, you know, once a week, maximum.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't let them play on any of these Game Boys and things.
To have a total control of
You know, and I explain to them why. Mm-hmm. You have to let them, once they get to the level where they can understand it, you have to explain to them why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make sense to them.
Mm-hmm.
And once they get older, there's nothing you can do about it. They're going to do what they want. The best thing you do is instill those principles and virtues in them at a young age. Inculcate as much as you can. And then the other thing I would say that's extremely important is empathy, is teaching your children empathy. Malay, mashallah, humility is a very natural thing for your people, which is a great blessing, because the Malay children, you know, they I can see it. They're just raised to be humble, which is a good thing. But also, you have to make sure that they're very confident. So you don't want them to be obsequious, you know, where they don't have a sense of self.
Okay.
You know, you want them to have a, you know, where they're not gonna, going to cave into pressure. You know, there was a man in South Africa, I think he was 105 or something, and he was asked about, you know, what it was like. Were there any perks at being so old?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, absolutely. And they said, what? And he said, no more peer pressure. Because nobody's alive of his age, right?
Oh.
So the point is, peer pressure is very strong.
Yes.
And when kids are young, it's very important they want to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
One of the things that I realized in homeschooling my children is that they were very individualistic, so they didn't need to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
But if you send them to a school, they get a herd mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And we're tribal people by nature. Humans are tribal.
Mm-hmm.
Orang Asli is our everybody's background. We all came from Orang Asli, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that, they want to be like others.
Mm-hmm.
They want to dress like them, eat like them, talk like them. And so you need to really instill in them a sense of self,
mm-hmm.
where they don't. The Prophet said, "Wattinu anfusakum," you know, that accustom yourselves not to being yes men.
Yeah.
إذا أحسن الناس أحسنتم. If people do good, you do good. وإذا أساء الناس أساءتم.
Mm-hmm.
And if people do bad, you do bad. Right? But
mm-hmm.
he said, but do good when they do good, and don't do bad when they do bad.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something you have to train kids to do that.
Mashallah.
Yeah. Anyway, I hope those are useful. Few things.
Inshallah. Another concern listeners, Abu Abdurrahman on Facebook, he asked, "Dear Sheikh Hamza, Muslims in Malaysia is increasingly divided religiously, politically, and socially.
Yeah.
Please advise us how to unite the
Muslims."
Well,
these are the fitan.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the fitan, Abu al-Qasim al-Samarqandi, who was a great student of Abu Mansur al-Maturidi, who died in the 4th century, late 4th century. He was from Samarkand. He's called Al-Hakim,
mm-hmm.
Which means the wise one. Anyway, he said that all of fitan come from three sources.
Mm-hmm.
And Imam Al-Ghazali quotes him, so obviously Imam Al-Ghazali concurs with him about this assessment. He said, "Tansha'u al-fitanu an thalathati nafar." All of fitan come from three people. Qa'ilu al-akhbar, طالب استماع الأخبار ومتلقي الأخبار, newscasters, news hounds, and consumers of news. And he said, "ولا يخلص أحد من الثلاثة أحد الثلاثة من الملامة, and none of the three are free from blame. So if that's true, if all fitna comes from newscasters, people spreading news, mm-hmm. people seeking news, and people consuming news, that means that we're in the age of fitna, mm-hmm. because the internet is either people spreading news, people looking for news, mm-hmm. or people consuming news. And so by the nature of the time we're in, it's an age of fitna, unfortunately. And the Prophet warned us about this, about the time of fitna. And one of the things he said, kun hilsan min ahlasi baytika, you know, cling to your home, because you can protect your home. So it's very important for people to recognize, we have to rectify ourselves and our homes, our children, we have to protect our children. But it's very important for people to understand that you have a sound Islam here, traditionally. Mm-hmm. It needs revamping. Islam always needs renovation, tajdeed. You have to renovate. Mm-hmm. But the basis of Islam in Malaysia is very sound. It is a sound Islam. Mm-hmm. It's to try to bring in foreign versions of Islam that aren't your own, mm-hmm. you're going to divide your people. Mm-hmm. And that you should be very wary of anybody that's teaching you a version of Islam that's different from what your ancestors taught you. Mm-hmm. That's the best advice that I could give you. Anybody that teaches you a different version of Islam than what your ancestors practiced, you should be very wary of it. And that doesn't mean that everything that they did, your ancestors did, was, you know, the best case thing or something. They were human. They might have had their faults and things like that. That's true. But we have a principle in Maliki Fiqh, mm-hmm. that if people are practicing something and the dalil is weak, and you have a stronger dalil, you should not try to impose that stronger dalil, because once it has become practice, to try to change the practice will create fitna. Mm-hmm. And so they actually saw that leaving people on what they were doing was better than trying to change it, even if it was better, if in changing it you would create dissension amongst the people. Mm-hmm. The thing about religion, the essence of our religion is to bind our hearts to God and then to bind our hearts to each other. That's the purpose of religion. And so if religion severs your tie with God because of the harshness of people, you know, now there's people turning away from religion because of the way it's being practiced. Mm-hmm. So if it severs your heart from God, it's not true religion. Yes. And if it severs your hearts from others, even non-Muslims,
yes.
if it's doing that, it's not true religion. Mm-hmm. Our Prophet didn't teach us to hate people. Mm-hmm. He said, "Dabba ilaykum da'ul ummam," the diseases of the civilizations has come to you. Al-hasdu wal-baghda, envy and hatred. Mm-hmm. That's the disease of competitiveness and the disease of civilizations that are in decay. Yeah. And he said, "Dabba ilaykum," it comes slowly. And so now that you can see these things starting to emerge, mm-hmm. in your society, Malaysia was never perfect. No society is.
Yes.
But it has a lot of blessings. People have been criticizing me for speaking so highly of Malaysia. They're like, "Brother, you don't know. You haven't been here. It's not like you think it is." I'm not stupid. I know that you have problems. Every country does. But my focus is to remind you, be grateful for what you have, for the yes. blessings you have. Mm-hmm. Be thankful. Don't complain all the time, because once you start complaining, Allah will take those blessings away from you. Be grateful for what you have, and He will increase your blessings. إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يُغَيِّرُ مَا بِقَوْمٍ حَتَّى يُغَيِّرُ مَا بِأَنفُسِهِمْ ذَلِكَ بِأَنَّ اللَّهَ لَمْ يَكُ مُغَيِّرًا نِعْمَةً أَنْعَمَ عَلَى قَوْمٍ حَتَّى يُغَيِّرُ مَا بِأَنفُسِهِمْ. Allah does not change blessings that He yes. gave to a people until they change what's in themselves in regards to those blessings.
Yes.
In other words, they don't honor those blessings. Mm-hmm. So Malaysia, you have the blessing of family. Guard your families. Protect your families. Preserve you. You have the blessing of treating old people with respect. Guard that. You have the blessing of children that obey your parents mm-hmm. to a large extent. Guard that. Protect that. You have the blessing of a government. I don't care how bad your government is, and I'm sure it's got problems. Every government does. But if you go outside, you have infrastructure. It's the government that's providing your water in your homes. It's the government that's facilitating the roads that you drive on. It's the government that's policing your streets so that people aren't robbed and accosted. That government is a great blessing just in and of itself, no matter how bad it is. My country is becoming increasingly like a tyrannical police state. It's still better than anarchy. It's still better than tyranny. There's a lot of problems in America. But those of us who live inside the country, we have to appreciate that there's social order. Once order breaks down, it's Syria. Ask the 5 million Syrian refugees what they think about the situation now. And if they could do it all over again, would they do it? Was it worth it? Was the Great Revolution worth it? Seriously, ask them. Ask the Libyans. Would they rather be under Gaddafi right now, or would they rather have the situation like it is? Ask the Iraqis if they'd like to have Saddam back, if it would bring order back to their society. The vast majority of them will tell you they would. So people have to be realistic. Things break down. Things fall apart. We have a global order right now that has incredible problems. There's a lot, and I am the first to criticize it. But let me tell you, in a world where the global order breaks down, you have neighbors with great power that don't have any qualms about coming and invading you because they've done it in the past. And if they want your natural resources, they'll come. Malaysia's not a strong military country. So when you have a society where it's the strong eat the weak, that's not a society that people that are weaker want to live in. We want social order, and that's why if you don't respect the weak in your society, the Orang Asli, the minorities here, if you don't respect them, then God won't respect you, and He'll send people here this is what He does. This is the Sunnah of God in His creation. We get what we deserve. Mm-hmm. And so that's my advice. You have Chinese people that live here, they're Malaysian. Mm-hmm. They're part of Malaysia. They're not Muslim, but they're Malaysian people, and they've been successful. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people have resentment about that, but they work hard. They're hard workers. They're committed to education. You have to see the good in them, and you shouldn't become envious of them because they have success in the world. They have success because they work hard. And minorities have an advantage. An advantage of a minority is that they tend to work together a lot because they feel that that they're in a country where the majority of people are not like them, and so they work out. That's why the Jewish community is so successful in America. But instead of envying them, you should see the virtues of being unified, of working together. Those are the things that you should learn from them,
Yes.
And then if they have earned what they have earned without hook or crook, then That's their prerogative in a state that is fair.
MashaAllah. Sure, today is your last day in Kuala Lumpur, am I right?
This is it, yeah.
Yes, and you're leaving first thing in the morning tomorrow. Inshallah. So to recap all your public lectures, remind us, what is your final advice to Malaysian Sheikh?
My final advice to myself and to all of you, وَلَقَدْ وَصَّيْنَا الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ وَإِيَّاكُمْ أَنَ اتَّقُوا اللَّهِ. We have advised you and the people before you to be pious, to have taqwa. And taqwa is to obey the injunctions of God and to avoid the prohibitions of God. He hasn't prohibited very many things. And all the things that He prohibited are harmful for people, for ourselves and for others. And what He's enjoined, the Prophet said, to do what you're able to. Because there's a lot. But at least do the fard. And try to build on that. And then I would say also just to have gratitude in your hearts. لَنْ شَكَرْتُمْ لَزِدَنَّكُمْ. If you're grateful, I'll increase you in blessings to be grateful for. But if you have kufr, if you have ingratitude, Allah tells us His punishment is immense. And then I would just say, as somebody, I know I've only been here for 2 weeks, but I've been here 3 times now. My experiences in Malaysia have been positive. Really, they've been very positive. I think the Malay people are beautiful people. Really, I'm not just saying this. I don't say this about everybody. I mean, generally, I find that people. I'm old enough, and I've been in so many places that generally people are actually decent. Human beings are. It's a decent species. We have a lot of flaws, but humans are actually, most people are good people. They're not bad people. Mm-hmm. And if they're treated with dignity, they tend to respond by treating you with respect. But if you step on them, if you crush them, if they get angry. Yes, you drop bombs on people, they get angry. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a fact of life. But the Malay people have a lot of really beautiful qualities that I haven't seen in other people. And I think of all of them, the thing that really strikes me the most is the adab. And I really hope
yes.
We're living in a time where just good manners are disappearing. You know, the internet, it's the rudeness on the internet, you know, the way people talk to each other.
Yes.
So I really hope that that you hold to that, you know, adab. Because the Prophet said, "Adabni Rabbi fa ahsana ta'dibi." My Lord gave me adab, and what a beautiful adab He gave me. And He said, "Innama bu'itu li utammima makarim al-akhlaq." I was only sent to complete noble character. So I really hope that, and I know that the worst thing in Malay is to have bi adab, you know. So it's, you know, and so that's it. And then yes. Also terima kasih, you know. I
terima kasih. Yes, welcome sama-sama. Actually, I have to apologize to you and our listeners that we cannot take calls from our listeners as time doesn't permit us. We've come to the end of the show, but Inshallah, Sheikh Hamza, we want to thank you and we hope to see you back here in Malaysia in future, inshallah. And may Allah reward you greatly for all the knowledge shared, and may Allah bless you. Ameen. And similarly, please make dua for Malaysians always. Jazakallah khair. Thank you once again. Assalamualaikum. Okay, untuk anda terus bersama di IKIM FM, pilihan utama anda kembali selepas ini bersama rakan tugas untuk Buletin IKIM FM.